And it really begins to enter into the historiography formally in the 1980s in the work of people like Joseph M. Curran, The Birth of the Irish Free State, 1980, Ronan Fanning, Independent Ireland, 1983, and perhaps most significantly, Tom Garvin's polemic, 1922, The Birth of Irish Democracy, published in 1996.
Now, the problem with this idea, I think, of the 1922 as the birth of Irish democracy is that it ignores a whole load of complicated things that happened at the time. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, and the critical thing about the construction of narratives is that big things go ignored. Historians are very good at detail, footnotes, the minutiae of political activity, but sometimes they miss the bigger picture. So in order for the democracy story to work, one has to either ignore or deny the fact of the British threat during the course of 1922. And so what we notice in treaty-type polemics during the Civil War is that the British threat of reconquest, if the treaty is rejected or in any way abrogated by the treatyites, the anti-treatyites, if there's any slip backwards towards the Republic, the British promise that they will meet that threat with violence. But there's a lot riding on this. The treaty is a empire settlement. It's not simply a matter of Anglo-Irish relations. And the British want the treaty. And they are insistent. And they threaten war to achieve it. What we notice in treaty propaganda is that that argument is played down. For the anti-treatyites, for the anti-treatyite Republicans, the threat of British violence is absolutely central because it means that there can be no free choices about the settlement. So we know, and it's well publicised, that the treaty settlement is arrived at in London under the threat of immediate and terrible war. Everybody agrees that. Everyone knows that. But that threat doesn't go away after the treaty is sent back to Dublin or once it's signed. That threat is ever constant throughout 1922. Now, the newspapers don't play it up, neither the treatyites or the British government, but it exists, and everyone knows it exists. So if the treaty is rejected, there will be consequences. And so the anti-treatyite position is partly rationalised by the fact that the people are not being given an opportunity to express themselves freely in 1922. When they've done so in 1918 and in 1921, and in 1920, in local elections and at general elections, they have, for the most part, voted for a Republican settlement. Even after the violence of the IRA kicks off mid-1920, there is still measurable support for the Republican position in the face of British retaliation and so forth in Ireland. So that's the big thing that is taken out of the equation within the history books. So we can see it diminished in treaty propaganda, more or less ignored in Williams' essay of 1966, but the really interesting thing occurs during the 1980s and 1990s when it is marginalised by people like Curran and people like Fanning, and by 1996, Tom Garvin denies that there was any threat of British violence in 1922. Mm-hmm. Now this is absolutely remarkable. So here we have a big event. We have a world power, Britain and the Empire, threatening violence on the not yet independent Irish state, or the proto-Irish state, if you want to call it that. And that's significant in international diplomacy. And so the big question is, how does that slip from memory, and how does that slip out of the historiography? Mm-hmm. Because it's no small matter at all. It is fundamental. It is fundamental to understanding opposition to the treaty, the rationale of the treatyites. It's fundamental to understanding the development of the British Commonwealth in the 1920s. It's fundamental to understanding why Fianna Fáil forms in 26 and takes power in 32, and also why they dismantle the treaty during the 1930s, all because they see it as being illegitimate. It was forced upon the Irish population, and by and large, the majority of people from 1932 back that policy of what Ronan Fanning calls the quest for independence.
Mm-hmm. So it begs the question, why was it ignored then by the 1990s? And why was it possible to say that this was Democrats versus like proto-fascists?
Yes, the word proto-fascists is used. That is difficult to explain. Partly we see the emergence of a consensus about a particular story that historians are telling about the state. So in the 1970s, but more particularly after 1980-83, historians seem to be telling the same story about the origins of the state. The state was born in a democratic revolution, with an eye on the future, or on the present, I should say, looking at the provisionals. Their violence is anti-democratic. Their violence has no mandate, no majority backing. And so the story there is that the state in the Republic is created through a democratic process, therefore the violence that was used to create it was okay, whereas the provost violence is not okay because it's anti-democratic.